Hey, this is Sunny Bunch of the Subbeacon. You know and love me and JVL and Vic, or maybe just me. I am the best after all. But we are at subbeacon.com now. We set up a Patreon account. Just as a reminder, you can go over there and listen to us via Patreon memberships. Our subscriptions, whatever you want to call them, are pretty varied. Just pay what you want, and we will be glad to have you. We'll still be here once a month or so. If that's all the Sunny Vic and JVL you want in your life, I could understand. We are pretty grating. But if you do want to keep listening to the show every week, it's at subbeacon.com. Just head over there, subbeacon.com, and we'll get you set up, okay?
Tell the story you know.
I hear you're hunting dangerous game.
This is different. This is about something.
I've put up with your suicidal drinking, your compulsive gambling, your silly platonic affairs.
I gave you a second chance.
How wealth and influence can crush a man.
Are you hoping I might absolve you of such a personal betrayal?
You made yourself court jester.
Nobody but nobody makes a monkey out of William Randolph Hearst!
You pick a fight with Willie, you are finished.
Menk. Mr. Mankiewicz!
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Subbeacon. I'm your host, JVL, along with Sunny Bunch and Victorino Mattis. Just a reminder that the Subbeacon used to be available on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, and now is available to you exclusively on Patreon at subbeacon.com. We also have a new store. We can buy Subbeacon merchandise ranging from masks to onesies to headache shirts. Just visit tpublic.com and search Substandard or Subbeacon, one of them. You'll easily find us. Please buy shirts, tell your friends to become patrons, and leave us reviews, suggestions, and ideas at subbeacon.com. Gentlemen, how are we? Sunny Bunch.
Hey, I have a question. Do I look better? Do I look clearer today? Am I
you
noticeably...
Do. Is it clearer still?
No, it's Noxzema. So I, as you guys have known for a while, and I don't want to jinx us. I feel like I might be jinxing us here. But my internet has been shaky. My internet has been a little bit shaky. And not it's right. the problem was ignorable when I wasn't working from home all the time with my wife doing, you know, four podcasts a week and everything else, watching 17 different streaming devices on 700 different channels. So I went out and invested in an Amazon Eero Wi-Fi system. And let me tell you, it has dramatically improved. It has dramatically improved the quality of my Wi-Fi setup here in the house.
So you were able to get something Wi-Fi related, not through your cable company, which tells you really you can only go through us for everything and how dare you.
Well, so I mean, I'd been using the terrible Wi-Fi box that they gave us, and it sucked. And I'd been trying to make it work with an extender. I got a Netgear extender, and the Netgear extender sucked because I was always bouncing off on different signals, and my computer was never sure where to go. But the Eero uses a mesh technology. I don't know what that means exactly.
Oh,
it's a mesh.
The mesh. No, there's a class action lawsuit
against
the mesh. It's
a mesh.
There's a class action lawsuit against
Wi-Fi
the mesh.
Mesh network. And yeah, I'm probably going to get, you know, cancer. Is that it?
If you got the
which
mesh.
Women's health device was that? Yeah. Anyway,
it's down there.
So anyway, I have to say it's dramatically improved my life, and I'm now downloading things at, like, you know, 400 megabytes a second, 500 megabytes a second. You know, things just like that. Just give me 40, a 30 gigabyte video game. I'm like this.
40
like
bods.
This, you guys.
40 bods per second.
So anyway, that has been the highlight of my week or so, getting that taken care of.
Very Victorino, nice. How are you?
I'm doing great, JVL, you know, getting in the Christmas spirit. Kate was outside putting on the lights while I was inside the house panning my schnitzel in the bathroom. No, just kidding. I was making dinner. and so, yes, and, doing fine. And, speaking of the, Christmas spirit over the weekend, so I went to, you know, see my knights and do a rosary. And then afterwards, one of the guys says, could you help us? We were delivering some equipment or appliance from a woman's home, a nice lady who was donating it to the Dominicans. And I'm like, I looked at the guy, who's going? And I see the three guys. They're on the older side. And, you know, one of them is rheumatoid arthritis. The other guy has bad knees. The other guy has, like, he just got pins in his arm last spring. And I'm like, sure, I'll help. What do we need to do? Oh, we just need to deliver a washer and dryer. I said, right up my alley. And so I said, how are we working this out? I said, oh, well, you know, our buddy Kenny's got the pickup truck. So, but we can't fit everybody in the truck, obviously. So that's why I'll take. Could we take your car? So I said, okay, we'll take two cars. So go to this woman's lovely home, and it's, you go in the basement, and it's like deep in, it's like still connected partly. I don't know what to do at this point, but I have to pretend that I know. Oh yeah, sure. Let's, I move washers and dryers all the time. And I don't even go to that part of the basement in my own house. So we looked at it, and then I believe my exact question was, well, are there wheels on it? And one of the guys then just looks at me and says, are you kidding? And I said, yeah, of course I'm kidding. Okay.
it's just a joke. Funny jokes.
Okay, what are we doing? So the good thing is they could use me for my, obviously, for my strength, as you know.
Your brawn.
But for my brawn, but clearly not for my brain, because they're like, well, we can't get out of this door. So first of all, let's disconnect the stuff, obviously, and then throw it in here. And then we're going to have to pop the door out. And I'm like, yes, pop the door out. And so yes. And so thankfully, the older guys who are only in their 60s were able to do that in like 2 seconds. Now, the funny thing is about the knights is, you know, almost all the knights I know are like, they're masons, electricians, builders, craftsmen type guys.
They're not
Freemasons, no, in construction and stuff like that. And I guess that's maybe only 1% of them are editors, as it turns out. But so they knew what to do, and then we got it in
100. There's 100 people in your club.
That's right. And we put it on the flatbed. Then we had, little did I know, we was going to the Dominican house across from the Shrine and Catholic University in lovely Brookland. So drove into the city and delivered it to Father Antoninus at Dominican House. And that was my, almost my whole, that all Saturday, was doing that and then bringing them back. But that really is my Christmas message to all of you and to all of our listeners, which is, if you get a chance, do a good deed this Christmas. And most importantly, tell as many people as possible that you did the good deed so you can feel good about yourself.
Yeah.
That's, I think it's straight from the Bible. I think I heard that once in church.
It's in the Chinese Bible. I have a question for you, Victor, that has nothing to do with the story you just told. I was more interested in the lights part. Do you, in your guys' neighborhoods, are there like professional light putter uppers?
No.
Are there people who go around in trucks?
Yes,
putting up
I believe pipe? They're called dads, except for at my address.
Because that's a thing in Dallas. That's a
You mean like so? Like you get people like the leaf blower guys, and you get and then you have people who actually
who like come to the house and they all look the same. They all like have these lights clipped up on the gutters.
Careful.
No. The lights all look the same.
Oh, I thought JVL was good at thinking. Yeah. Okay.
They're all put up. They're all like just like white lights that point straight up that go on the gutters all around the house and then like the arch of the house. And I'm kind of fascinated by this. It's many services. There are dozens of professional Christmas light putter uppers. And it's something that I just have never seen before.
No,
but
they own the lights. They're not your lights.
Yeah, I think they own the lights. They come and they wrap them around the trees.
So it's like, not like, we got to buy the tile and then, you know, they
how much does it cost?
I don't know. Next year we're going to use them because I put up lights on our house and they look like trash because I'm a terrible light putter upper. I'm not a professional light putter upper. I'm an amateur light putter upper.
You put up lights on your house for
Christmas. I got up on a ladder and I put them on the gutter and they look terrible. Let me tell you, they're pale. They're colored like different colors. They're not all white. So the house It doesn't fit in.
No, I bet they frown on that in Texas.
That was actually much more awkward than I had intended to phrase it. But like we have multicolored lights. We have like red and green and purple and yellow or whatever. But it's like the only house on the block that does. And I'm a little bit afraid that everyone is judging us, me specifically.
Well, good. You're only the new kids from back east.
Well, they're all commenting the way we all come. I always come and look out the window and talk about.
Did you see what's going on at that house? That? I'm glad we haven't bothered to meet them because nobody.
I gotta say, Sonny, I am shocked that you were a Christmas exterior light kind of guy.
Oh, I'm not.
Oh,
well, good for her. Good for
Beth
her.
Is very oh. Beth, she likes decorations. I'm not, but it was like, if one of us is going to get up on the ladder and put it up there, it should probably be me. I don't need the neighborhood judging me.
That's what my wife
me.
Said. My wife said the exact same thing.
I don't need the neighborhood judging me, not only for my bad lights, but also the fact that I made my wife get up there and do it. It's, you know, it's me. Now she's shaking her fist at me through the door right now. But anyway, it's weird. I was
light
curious.
Service. I'm surprised? Now, having seen your lights compared to the neighbor's lights, the service may probably slip one of their flyers.
They'll target you.
In your they mailbox should. Say, hey. It's they like should. The ones I always get about, like, you know, like for your grass and stuff like that, for your lawn, you know? It's like, oh, clearly they look
they should
at
come and they should come and just be like, hey, we'll do it for free this year, but next year you got to pay because you look your house looks terrible. You're bringing down the rest of our housework that we've done in this neighborhood. I don't know. I thought so. This is I'm sorry. I'm going on and on about this, but like I can't tell if I like am in a nicer neighborhood than I thought I was. If this is a thing that happens in other, but you live in a pretty nice neighborhood, Vic and JBL, but nobody does anything like this in your guys' neighborhoods,
right?
No,
that must be just something. No, I've never seen this anywhere in our neighborhood. And the lights are all very unique. That's how you could tell also, you know, different levels of skill, you know.
All right. So, Sonny, what is the price point at which you would waver on doing it?
Are you saying what is the most I would spend on this?
Right. So the dollar at which you go, I don't know if I'd really want to spend the money on that.
Can I put a bid in there too?
Yeah.
Sure. Why don't you guys guess? Here, wait, hold on. I'll write down a number on my phone and then I'll show it to you. You guys
this
guess.
It's more exciting give me one, than the price is right.
Give me one sec. Exciting. Okay. I've got a number.
Okay. And this includes both setup, takedown, and rental.
Total price. The most amount of money I'd be willing to spend on this.
All right. Victorino. And Vic is not guessing your answer. Vic is giving you his own answer.
Yeah. 200. Okay. 200. That's right. Laughing too low, laughing too high. That's what I'm intrigued by. But go ahead.
Stunning.
JBL, what's your answer?
Probably 800.
Oof.
What? Man, that's crazy.
Rockefeller Center?
What I put. Oh, well, you can't. It's backwards. It's 225.
Think of this as an hourly rate, right? I mean, this is what does it cost? You pay $400 to get somebody to rake the, you know, vacuum up the leaves.
I pay $50 every 2 weeks for our lawn service.
There must be a labor cost.
I pay
different in Texas than it is
$50 every 2 weeks. It's great.
Wow.
In cash.
Care.
Yeah, I'm not signing out $10.99.
Careful. Yeah, well. Careful. Okay. Yeah. Very interesting.
All right. So can I tell you guys a little bit about I got a love-hate thing for you.
JVL. Ooh,
start with the hate.
How are you?
How do you I find it hard to believe that you hate somebody.
Victorino, did you like my intro?
It was very good. It was mellifluous.
Thank you. So I'll start with the love. You guys know that there are a bunch of holidays that we just don't celebrate in my house. Like, you know, Mother's Day, Father's Day, stuff like that. Pass. Don't do it. But I have one holiday which I like celebrate the crap out of, which is my anniversary. Because my wedding anniversary is very, very special to me.
Oh, wait a minute. I am super duper. Yes.
So I am, but I would pay $800 to have somebody come on and put up lights just for my anniversary. Better than Christmas. Oh. And our friends at the SSEU got me an anniversary present because my anniversary was this past weekend, and I would like to show it to you. Vic, this is going to blow your fucking mind.
They know your anniversary. Go ahead. Okay, there's a little bit of a reflection. Who is on the cover of this Star Wars comic? What is that?
That is Star Wars,
the original Star Wars
one.
What?
The original Star Wars. You had this when you were a kid, didn't you?
The comic book?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't collect it, but wow, look at that.
So this is one of the all-time great comic book covers. And it
what
has...
What is that behind them? Because that's not Darth Vader.
The Death Star. No, Darth Vader. The green... This is a green Darth Vader. There's a Death Star here. But what is so amazing about this cover is that it is both perfectly balanced, but also exploding with action. Like, you get everything is, you know, Luke is stepping out of the frame. You've got X-Wing, TIE Fighter,
it's funny, I thought you said
Y-Wing, A-Wing. They're all sort of flying out of the page at you. You've got this giant Luke up here in the top left.
That's right. Instead of where normally the Spider-Man Marvel would be there or somebody.
Yeah. It's just, it's cool. Crackling with energy. And I had this. I remember I bought it at the local Five and Dime in Woodbury, New Jersey when I was a kid. 30 cents. And I read that comic book, I don't know, 75,000 times until it just fell apart and disintegrated.
Question.
Yeah.
Question. Did that comic come out before the movie came out?
No, after.
Okay, because I seem to remember there was maybe I'm thinking of the novelization. I don't remember. There's something that came out before the actual movie came out that was used as
really
like PR for the movie.
Yeah. Well, did they have it? Amazing. Is it like in that encased? It's encased and certified. One of those things.
No, it's not graded. I will probably it's in a very high quality sleeve. I will probably. Get
oh,
it
very
graded.
Nice.
Because mine
with an acid back. Is there an acid back thing?
Of course. Of course. Acid free backing. Anyway, it was
very
like
nice.
Finding Rosebud or something. Nice. It was amazing.
Speaking
I should
of which,
save that because it would have been a transit. No, I, you know what? Yeah. So let's do speaking of which, and I will save my hate for the outtakes.
No, I want to.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You had hate. I'm sorry.
Wait, hold on. The first issue of Star Wars was published in April of 1977.
Really?
Ooh.
Yes.
Wow.
So that's this wild. Was out before. So this thing must have been sitting on the racks and had been in the racks because this happened at the Five and Dimes, right? They would just get new comic books and old comics would just sit there because they didn't return on sale. Yeah.
So yeah, I remember this. God, I'll have to send you the name of the book for show notes because I can't remember what it is right now. I think it was Chris Taylor's History of Star Wars. But there was all sorts of pre-movie promo. They went to conventions, they went to comic book conventions, they had this comic book. They did all sorts of stuff for this before it was even out to create buzz, to create, you know, pre-awareness of the movie.
That's insane.
Well, anyway, my heart was touched by this from Chris and Ryan and Thomas and everybody in the SSEU. And I really can't thank you guys enough. And it was like finding a tiny little piece of my childhood again. So thank you. That's my love. That's what I have. And I accidentally backed into a transition to speaking of Rosebuds.
Oh, you sure you don't want to talk about your hate?
I'll save it.
All right.
Save it.
But we can't transition right to Mank yet. We got to talk about HBO Max.
Oh.
They're Warner Brothers.
Right. There you go. That's right. Good.
I don't want to put Vic to sleep.
Vic, you're into it.
So
you're
all
into
the movies are coming out ahead of time.
It's big. This is actually big news. And people were asking if we were going to talk about it. I have thoughts about this.
All right. Fire off.
Yeah. So, Sonny, this is pitting your two great loves against one another.
Yeah.
Because HBO Max has decided to destroy the theatrical experience. Mm. And you love the theatrical experience, but you also are an HBO Max fanboy. The only way this could be worse is if Zack Snyder weighed in
Well, Zack Snyder is involved in all this because Zack Snyder is releasing his cut of the Justice League on HBO Max.
Right. Oh, I guess so. He's Team Max.
He's Team HBO Max. No, I mean, look, this is huge news. The fact that Warner Brothers, that AT&T has told Warner Brothers, and that's how this happened. It's not like Warner Brothers was like, oh, we're going to do this. AT&T has told Warner Brothers that they have to release their next entire year's worth of film, their entire 2021 slate on HBO Max and in theaters simultaneously. So basically everything from Dune to The Matrix 4 to The Sopranos prequel to everything is going to be on HBO Max at the same time as that it is in theaters. And this is, look, this is a real shot across the bow of the entire theatrical business. I mean, I like, it is the sort of thing that happens and you're like, wait, how do theaters survive this? And nobody really knows. Nobody quite knows what to make of it.
Boy, so much for your great new
Lord Vigo
Crowder.
See, I told you it was a risk. I'm still here. We're still going.
No, your network's really bad right now.
It'll be back. So
you've been away for 20 minutes.
Anyway, I think it's a real issue.
You were saying it is the sort of thing that makes you ask how the theaters can stay in business. Right.
The big question to my mind is, do the theaters actually play the movies? And I don't think that that's a sure thing. I think that is I think there's a very real chance that Cinemark and AMC and the rest say, no, we're not going to do this. And if that happens, then maybe Warner Brothers goes all HBO Max all the time. If they do that, then it, you know, creates all sorts of problems with talent because talent doesn't want to, you know, work for a streamer. They want that theatrical, and they want the money that theatrical gives over. Because look, this is the other problem here is that, you know, Warner's is essentially trading theatrical dollars for digital pennies. And they're asking their partners to do the same. They, you know, Legendary, which co-financed and co-produced Kong versus Godzilla, right? Or Godzilla versus Kong, whatever that dumb sequel is. They're getting ready to sue because they were not kept in the loop on this. And they are like, we're losing out on tons and tons of money. This isn't fair to us. This isn't what we signed up for. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's a real question. What's going to happen?
And the weirdness of this is that, you know, Warner's doesn't finance its movies entirely by itself. That's not how the world works anymore, right? You have financing partners and all of this. And because it was impossible to take a move like this and tell five people but not have it told to everybody, they just ambushed everyone. And so you have a whole bunch of people who spent money to make these movies, and Warner's is now going to say, screw you. And it's going to change the type of movies get made. This is the other thing. I mean, the economics do not work for a $300 million blockbuster on streaming. You cannot do it.
You cannot spend $200 million on a streaming movie. Netflix did it once with The Irishman, and that's it.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you just can't do it.
And what that, okay, so as you start following the logic chain, so you tell you, okay, well, you can't do giant, big blockbusters, which also means then that you are going to stop making the big valuable intellectual property. This is what the valuable thing, Richard Rushfield wrote about this week, the valuable thing about the movies is that it creates these giant rivers of intellectual property that you use to sell lunchboxes and action figures and theme park rides and all. And, you know, ain't nobody nowhere is building a Stranger Things theme park. Although Vic would love that. Yeah. You know, like just the cultural impact of streaming is so tiny and minute compared to the movies. And the movies can create these giant cultural events that just can't be done on streaming. Can't be done. It's not like streaming hasn't tried. Yeah.
Did they? Question, since I wasn't paying attention to just now. Is this just the thing that HBO Max is doing until COVID is gone?
They say it's for this year. Who knows?
And then, like, it reverts after.
Sonny, should the theaters Air HBO movie? Or, sorry, Warner Brothers movies? If you were the king of AMC, what would you do?
If I am the king of AMC, I don't know, man. It's because the problem here is that there's just so little content anyway. And there are so few people who are willing to go to the theaters anyway, that if you cut out, you know, a third of the big tentpole releases in any given year, I don't know that you can save theaters. I mean, I wouldn't do it unless I was getting something like 70% of the revenue from the tickets instead of 50% or 60%. You know, I would hold pretty firm and be like, if you want your movies to be here, if you want your people to be happy to make movies for you anymore, then you're going to have to give us 70% of every ticket sold.
Who are you rooting for? Christopher Nolan tweeted. Do you have the Christopher Nolan tweet in front of you?
I can pull it up real quick. I'm rooting for the theaters because I do think the theaters are getting kind of screwed here. I mean, they obviously weren't told about any of this ahead of time, and you know, they are in bad straits as it is. But so here is what Christopher Nolan said. This is the quote that he sent to the Hollywood Reporter. Some of our industry's biggest filmmakers and most important movie stars went to bed the night before thinking they were working for the greatest movie studio and woke up to find out they were working for the worst streaming service. Warner Brothers had an incredible machine for getting a filmmaker's work out everywhere, both in theaters and in the home, and they are dismantling it as we speak. They don't even understand what they're losing. Their decision makes no economic sense, and even the most casual Wall Street investor can see the difference between disruption and dysfunction. And I mean, that's about right. I mean, that's about right. That's what it comes down to. Again, there's a case to be made for streaming. There's a case to be made for having a streaming service. But as the entertainment strategy guy, who is a very, very smart and very informed taker on these things. He knows many things. He offers very good takes. You know, the simple fact of the matter is that, like, if you think that this is the smart thing to do, what you're saying is that each of these movies is worth $200 to $400 million just in streaming exclusivity, each one of them, because all of these movies were going to end up on HBO Max anyway. They were going to end up on HBO Max 3 months later. It makes no sense. It makes no financial sense to say, well, they're worth, you know, $300 million to have it there exclusively 90 days before they'd be on HBO Max anyway. That's just, it doesn't make any sense.
So two points in response, and I know we are taxing Victorino's patience on this. The first is that the counterpoint on this is, if you were to, it's the first point is, even the stock market, of course, didn't like erupt in joy over this, right? If this was such a home run, then you would have expected like a 10% jump in AT&T stock.
AT&T stock went up like 30 cents or something.
Yeah. But the other point is, if I were going to make the counter argument, it would be, let's pretend we are just fast forwarding by a year. And a year from now, I tell you, hey, HBO Max now has 45 million subscribers. A streaming service with 45 million subscribers, how much is that worth if I were to just stand it up as an IPO it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a new tech company and I have a streaming service and I have 45 million paying subscribers and I'm going to stage my IPO. What would I be valued at? And the answer is probably something like $25 billion or something.
Sure. Here's the problem, right, with this is that HBO already has 40 million subscribers. The problem is that they can't convert those HBO subscribers to HBO Max users for a variety of reasons. One, brand confusion. They've done a terrible job explaining this to people. But two, they're still not on Roku. How do you make this deal without a Roku deal in your pocket? How do you do that? I don't understand how you announce this enormous world-shifting thing without already having the Roku deal in your pocket, because now Roku just says, fuck you, pay me. I don't get it.
Do you remember what John Stankey said about the brand confusion question?
No, I don't remember. What did he say?
So he was asked early in the, when they announced the HBO Max details, this is months and months ago, and people said, wait, hold on. Wait, so you've got HBO Go and the thing HBO Max, and one of them costs like a dollar less than the other, but has a lot more, but they're still two separate products. Like, that doesn't make sense. And his response was, we view this as sort of an IQ test for our customers. And, you know, if they are smart, then they'll figure out that they should all just be signed up for HBO Max.
Yeah. Yeah, they shifted away from that pretty quick.
Is that maybe the worst businessing you've ever heard?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that you should always remember about your customers is that they're dumb. Is that they're dumb and they don't know what they're doing, and that you have to handhold them every step of the way. And if you don't have the thing on Roku's home screen where they can just be like, oh yeah, I'd like to sign up for this, they'll never do it. Roku's like 30% of the market, 40% of the market. It's like... The doing this without having Roku in hand is insane. It's insane.
All right.
I would now subscribe. I would subscribe to Cinemax Max if they had a
Cinemax Max.
How about
Cinemax Brazzers Dark Max?
How about Brazzers Max?
You know, I believe they had Brazzers Max.
Like, how much more could you get? I got an email from AMC how you can rent the theater for your own private viewings now. Did you see that?
Yeah,
and it does for parties and such. It would be great. It would be like, I should do that. Like, for the first time ever, AMC presents Emmanuel in Space. It would be great.
How do you get the movie, though?
I don't know.
There's a list. They have like 40 titles that you can
just 40.
We should get from. Do this just there for my Sub-Beacon listeners.
Yeah, there goes my chances. Yeah.
I'm 100% serious about this. If we could rent it out for like $1,000 or something, rent it out, and everybody who's in the area for the Sub Beacon, come. Well, I'll hand you a KN95 as you walk in. We could all watch a movie together in a theater. That'd be amazing. All right, I'm going to investigate this. We're not here to talk about HBO Max, though. We're here to talk about a new movie by David Fincher on the Netflix service called Mac. Right. Did I do that all right? Or was that? See, look, it's subpar announcing. And I, you know.
Mank. Speaking of.
Mank. Yeah. That's
Mank.
Speaking of rosebuds.
Wank.
Sonny, would you care to do a big boy review?
Mank is David Fincher's movie about the writing of Citizen Kane. Kind of. It's only kind of about the writing of Citizen Kane. It's actually about one man's struggle with his integrity and the machine of Hollywood and the agonies that he faces as he decides how much he wants to sell out and how quickly. I liked Mank, which is directed by David Fincher, who listeners will remember from Fight Club and Gone Girl and other such
seven?
Movies.
Did he do Seven?
Seven. Mm-hmm. Alien 3. The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. Zodiac.
The Social Network.
So... Mank is shot in black and white. It is intended to kind of ape the look of movies from the age of Citizen Kane. It doesn't really, because it's a much different kind of black and white. It's, I don't know, it's filmier, it's dreamier. It's not quite as stark or as crisp as the shots that Greg Toland did for Citizen Kane. Look, I like this movie a fair amount. I actually watched it twice. I watched it again last night to prepare for this because I know how much JBL hates it because he was texting us about how much he hated it. Here's what I like about it. I think it is very sneaky and sly in what it is doing. It is nominally about the writing of Citizen Kane and the struggle for credit between Herman Mankiewicz and Orson Welles, the boy genius from radio who blew into Hollywood and showed all those idiots how to make movies. But it's only very nominally about that. It's much more about the kind of political and socioeconomic backdrop of Hollywood and America during the Great Depression and just after the run-up to World War II. And what's kind of... Again, what is kind of sneakily interesting about this movie is what he does with Hollywood and politics. There's a subplot in the film, Louis B. Mayer and Irving Thalberg are, you know, trying to win the 1934 gubernatorial race for the Republican candidate. They put the Hollywood Dream Factory to work for the filthy Republican who wants to defeat Upton Sinclair, the commie agitator. And there are essentially three ways to read this. The first and most obvious and kind of straightforward reading is these Hollywood stooges, these moguls who aren't really moguls of anything, that they're in the pocket of this fabulously wealthy William Randolph Hearst. They're evil, and they're evil because they're backing Republicans. That's the most straightforward.
Yes.
Reading. The second reading is okay. It's wrong to you. The power of Hollywood is great, and you have to be very careful in how you use it and how you manipulate the public with your dream factory. That's kind of a more nuanced and subtle reading. But the third and frankly kind of insane reading is the one I subscribe to, which is that it's actually, so here's a movie that is released in 2020, a year in which Hollywood is unanimously against one candidate who is running for office. It is about how the system and peer pressure and all of that is used to crush any opposition to, you know, protesting against the use of Hollywood to elect one candidate over the other. And it stars Gary Oldman, who is one of the most notably heterodox thinkers in Hollywood. He is often described as a conservative, whatever. And you have him in the role of the dissenter here. You have him in the role of the guy who is saying, no, we shouldn't be doing this. It's wrong. It's wrong to crush people like this. It's terribly dyspeptic about the role Hollywood plays in politics. And it is that way throughout. And I don't think that the simple takeaway here is the right one. I think the slightly more complex takeaway is the right one. And on top of all that, you know, it's a movie about principle, right? It's about Mank standing up and saying, no, we need to be principled. We need to do things that are right. And the only time he ever actually stands up and says, I'm going to do the thing that's right, is when it involves him getting credit for the movie that he wrote. It's him saying, I deserve credit for this, and I'm going to get it. And my people in Hollywood are going to back me because I'm from here. They're not going to back you, you outsider, Orson Welles. Again, very dyspeptic, very kind of skeptical of Hollywood as any sort of land of idealism. And that's what I like the most about it. It's a weirdly dark movie, but we shouldn't be surprised because David Fincher is a guy who made, if you look at like Gone Girl, for instance, Gone Girl is a movie that is nominally kind of an airport thriller type book, right? But it's actually a pretty devastating deconstruction of the American media complex and the way that warps perceptions of reality. Fight Gone Club
Girl,
is a movie.
Gone Girl was like trying too hard to ace my quadrants. I like the idea, the violence and the sex, but not at the same time. Not at the same time. No! That was like the remake of Halloween or whatever it was. It's great, great, great. No, you know, I don't want to sit down. No, I didn't even get a chance to hit pause. So anyway.
And then you have a movie like Fight Club, which is nominally about it's nominally a critique of consumerism. And what it actually is a warning about what will follow godless consumerism, godless fascism. He is often working at a surface level that is like kind of obvious and pleasing, but has a much darker and deeper subtext. And I think the subtext here is uniformity in Hollywood is bad. There, I'm done.
Sonny, you're like a nesting doll. Always like levels within levels of you. Every episode we learn something.
I believe I texted you.
You did
midway through and said that I can't wait to hear what you have to say because this is the worst quadrant score any movie you have ever seen will ever get.
It's funny.
Am I wrong or am I right?
It's funny. The duration is actually longer than Citizen Kane. And well, there's not really any violence. And certainly, you know, on the other two quadrants of sex, nudity, and plot, it's questionable.
There was a girl wearing pasties.
I like this movie, believe it or not. Yeah, I did. And that's why I didn't text you at all. I was like, I'll wait till he finds out how I felt. I actually was very much looking forward to this. I'm such a big Gary Oldman fan. I mean, I'd seen Citizen Kane, and I was somewhat familiar with the RKO story and Orson Welles and Mank, Herman Mankiewicz himself. All these guys, I really find it interesting because they were – it's basically, you know, they're doing what – they're living – it's the Sonny Bunch, dream, which is, you know, journalists who then, you know, write for Hollywood. I mean, this is – you're almost, you know, it's practically Sonny. So it's written for – you know, I mean, if you think about, you know, who are the guys that they mentioned in the room there? Who are there? George S. Kaufman's in there, right? Ben Hecht, all those guys. I'm into that. I found it very fascinating. And William Randolph Hearst. It helped
Charles
that,
Dance, the great Charles
yeah,
Dance.
Yeah. Oh, and Charles Dance, please. Also, I love Lily Collins. I really do. And her big, black, bushy eyebrows, which I'm sure she has to trim a lot. I'm talking about the eyebrows. I loved her. I don't know why. Don't make that face to me. I'm a big fan of Lily. I fell in love with her in The Blind Side. Do you remember how she was adorable in The Blind Side? She was Sandra Bullock's daughter. Yes, The Blind Side was made earlier this year, by the way. That came out earlier this year. I believe she was.
Yeah. Blind Side, the 2008?
No, I'm sure she was 18. I mean, you know how a lot of these actors are always older than they portray? She might have been portraying a younger girl, but I'm pretty sure she was 18 at the time. Don't check. Anyway, love Lily Collins. And I was like, oh, forget about Amanda Seyfried. Lily Collins is where it's at now in 2020. So I was like, Sonny's sitting back there. Don't be scared. We're going to have to bleep this whole section.
Get away from the computer.
No, believe it or not, JVL, I like this movie. And amazingly, I got it. I understood what was happening. And I liked it better than Citizen Kane, because when I saw Citizen Kane, yeah, that's right, laugh it up. It was like in the late 90s, AFI had come out with their top 100, like, oh, the top 100 movies of the century, right?
So I remember that.
Oh, I cut out, I printed it out and stuck it on a thumbtack on my corkboard. Go ahead, Sonny. What are you going to say?
So you watched it like the women from Sopranos?
I did.
You remember the Sopranos
episode where they, Janice is like something, she made a joke about Rosebud too.
Number one movie of the AFI. We should watch
right,
it.
Right, right. What did you say?
Carmella's like, well, the cinematography was good.
And then Janice made a joke about Rosebud, right? Something like that. So, but of course, what I got was, you know, the VHS cassette from Blockbuster. And the quality is so awful on those. You know, I mean, I tried to watch a lot of those black and whites. I can name probably in one hand the black and white movies of the time that I actually like, right? And otherwise, it's just very difficult to watch. It Happened One Night is a very good movie in black and white, and Sunset Boulevard. I'm not talking about modern movies that are made in black and white. So, I mean, the advantage that Fincher has is they spend so much time paying attention to how important it is to contrast the colors you need to have in order to make it stand out. And it really was, I thought it was very sharp when I watched Mank, and I appreciated that. I thought it was, and the music, don't forget Trent Reznor. They used only instruments that were available, I believe, from 1941, so it really had this dated, wonderful feel. Also, I am not a film person, but I do notice in the corner where the mark where they have to change reels, you know what I'm talking about?
Cigarette burns.
Oh, they did it.
Yeah. So that's not an effect. They actually filmed it that way.
As those of us from a certain age will remember, like the introduction to that in Fight Club, which is the
come on,
Sonny frozen again.
Sorry, you're back. Repeat the some of us who can remember.
Some of us will remember it from Fight Club. The cigarette burns.
Oh, he did it for that too.
Yeah,
well, that's weird.
Yeah, full explainer.
I I liked it. So I have some other notes. John Houseman is the John Houseman, which is the funny thing. So, I mean, yeah. We were watching last week Scrooge, and there's John Houseman as the narrator, the old man. And, of course, he was Ricky Schroeder's grandfather in Silver Spoon. And there he is. So really absolutely fascinating. And, it really, you hardly see Orson Welles, but of course the big problem was of his enormous ego. And so, also San Simeon, my notes are very scattershot here. I almost did a tour of it. We didn't have enough time when I was in California, but you could not do like just an entire tour of San Simeon. They broke it up into like three or four different packages, and you can only choose one because it took that long to tour the entire estate. Fascinating. So, believe it or not, I liked Mank.
That amazes JBL. Me. I did think to myself that early in the movie, Mank goes into the executive washroom on the MGM lot.
That's exactly right.
Like, and it's the bamboo in Jersey or
that's
something.
That's what it Goodness was like. Gracious. They had a trough even in the executive washroom on a Hollywood studio.
I wonder how many other people noticed that, because that really stuck out at me. I'm like, ugh.
I literally wrote it down. I have men's room has a trough, all caps with an exclamation mark. So it's a gimmick movie. It's a movie about the making of Citizen Kane, shot in the style of the era of Citizen Kane. It is, in fact, as one of the characters says about his screenplay for Citizen Kane, they say, it's a hodgepodge of talking episodes that skip around in time. And that's what this is. And I really,
don't sugarcoat it. You hated it.
No, I do. So this is, I hate is a strong word. I didn't enjoy it. But with it in the rear, I like it more afterwards than I liked while watching it. Does that? Mm-hmm. But sure. There are things that bother me about it. So first of all, it's a movie about politics and not about writing. And at that point, like, who the fuck cares? Like, what? I'm sorry, I am not especially interested in.
But it's not
seeing
about
a Norman Mankiewicz movie about politics. I'm much more interested in a Norman Herman Mankiewicz movie about writing, because that's what he did. Yeah, especially because he is this fast. We had Vic. You will help me. I am positive we had like a 5,000 word piece in the back of the book at the Standard about Mankiewicz
maybe.
At one point in time. And
I always think there's also Frank Mankiewicz, but he's the political guy. He's the campaign guy.
He's a super interesting guy. And, you know, the key thing to understand about him is that he is half Oscar Wilde and half Oscar Schindler. So, you know, he had been moving this entire.
Oh, yeah.
Over to, you know, and just as essentially a underground railroad of just pulling people out of the old country because things were going very bad, and he was getting them into America before things went really, really bad. And so he is a hero in that way, and he is a mensch in a way that you would not expect from just looking at the surface of him. And that's a very, like, he's just an interesting character. You know, he's a wit and a gadfly, but underneath it has a heart of gold. That is all very interesting. And so the least interesting thing about his, you know, so he is a gadfly with a heart of gold who did something kind of important without people really knowing it. He wrote what may be the greatest movie of all time, and yet we're supposed to be more interested in his views on Upton Sinclair. And
it's not his views on Upton Sinclair that we are supposed to be interested in. It's his inability to like actually take a stand when it matters that we should be interested in.
Also,
like what's amusing about that whole sequence is, you know, while all of this is happening, he's crapping on the new Writers Guild, right? He's saying, oh, this is dumb. You know, the writers all get enough money. What are we worried about? And then at the end of the film, again, when Orson Welles comes to him and says, you know, arbitration will rule against you. He's like, no, they won't. Mm-hmm. No, they won't. I will rely on them to get me what I want because I am an insider. I have influence and sway here that you don't and never will. And again, it's not, he's, the whole thing is kind of presaged as his big stand on principle, but there's nothing principled about what he does. It's totally self-serving.
But if that's all this is really about, then why do we need this movie with Hurst? And
because he is just as absurd and just as debased as Hurst.
I disagree. I think he's much less absurd and much less debased. And to me, again, this is I am complaining they didn't make the movie I wanted, but I am much more interested in how a washed up writer, because he was washed up, and we all know guys like this, the supremely talented.
No names, please. No, I'm serious. Names.
No names, because people will listen to the show. But it is true that we know very, very formerly talented writers who can't do it anymore. And they get by on because they're incredibly charming, right? I mean, we know people like this who are super fun to have at parties. Everybody loves. They always are quick-witted and all, right? But they're washed up as writers anymore. And that's a really like a tragic, horrible, very interesting thing. And to have a guy who is at that place in his professional career by like age 44.
Shocking.
And who is then able to pull himself out of it to write Citizen fucking Kane is really interesting.
You can't dramatize writing.
No.
You can't dramatize writing. And what they do is they dramatize the decline. I mean, that whole sequence where Louis B. Mayer's like, do you know who's paying half your salary? It's this man, William Randolph Hearst. And the look on Gary Oldman's face when he realizes that he's been carried this whole time by William Randolph Hearst.
Not to mention the gambling debt that was forgiven.
It's devastating. Well, I mean, yeah, the whole gambling thing.
It's funny. Go ahead.
Somebody described this movie as the Ready Player One for Hollywood, old Hollywood nerds.
Oh yeah.
And like the number one scene here is the Louis B. Mayer speech to the assembled stars of MGM.
Yeah.
Which is a real thing that happened. That's a thing that happened. He essentially broke the back of the unions for a time being by going to everyone at MGM and saying, I'm taking a pay cut. I need you to take a pay cut too. And he had orchestrated this thing where Lionel Barrymore stands up and says, I'll do it, LB, I'll do it. And then Shirley Temple's like, me too.
The real hero of this movie is Louis B. Mayer, by the way. I don't know if you know that. I liked him. Arliss Howard is great. You know what I also
need to have Thalberg as the villain.
Oh, that's really, you know, I mean,
isn't that funny?
Until recently,
he's much more the villain than Hearst is.
Totally. Until recently, that's the Lifetime Achievement Award was the Irving Thalberg Award. I think they recently
it's not anymore.
I feel like didn't they rename it for somebody else now or no? It's still. Oh, you know what I'm thinking of? I'm thinking of
the Humanitarian Award.
Also the Irving Kristol Award for AI, which was formerly the what award? I forget it was. Who was it? Anyway, funny. But it is still the Lifetime Achievement Award for the Oscars.
I do have one real sort of meta gripe about this, which is Netflix making a loving movie about the golden age of Hollywood.
Not loving. Very cynical.
I don't think it's cynical. Oh, I think it's very loving.
How is this a loving portrait of the golden age of Hollywood? All of the moguls who we've been raised to believe are great men are corrupt assholes. Yeah. The entire thing, the whole scene with the script writers like faking a shoddy Frankenstein ripoff because they're too lazy to actually write and come up with a real story. I mean, there's nothing loving about this portrait of old Hollywood. It is deeply, again, it's deeply dyspeptic. It is deeply damning. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's an interesting read. I actually read it very differently, which is as a quasi-nostalgic look at old Hollywood. But the analogy I was going to make is that it would be like Joseph Stalin making a loving movie about the Romanov family.
So
because Netflix has come to murder Hollywood And here they are like, look at how great things used to be in Hollywood. Look, this is what dolly shots used to be done like, you know, before they had drones.
I think this is such a misreading of the movie. I think it's wrong.
I like Sonny's interpretation about the point of the politics of it and how dangerous it is to use, you know, that Hollywood can be used for nefarious purposes. But also, you know, from scene to scene, you would see, it would say interior shot, you know, the how it types it out for you, you know, flashback, the whole thing, 1934. For somebody like me, I appreciated that. It helped me understand what was happening in the movie. Christopher Nolan should have done that in Tenet. That would have been really helpful.
Let me say one thing to push back on your interpretation of this, Sonny, which is that, I mean, so you say, you know, he couldn't stand up for the most important part of his life. And I think that's wrong, because the most important thing he did was bringing everybody over from the old country. And the political stuff, Sinclair versus Conrad, what's his face? Conrad Marion is actually just a sideshow. It's not important. Nothing changed. The world did not either rise or fall because Conrad Marion beat Upton Sinclair for the gubernatorial race of like 1936 or whatever fuck that was.
He thinks it's important.
But does he though? I mean, he thinks it's important, but it's not like really important. I think he has a reasonably jaded view of the ultimate importance of one of these guys over the other. And, you know, like that was not an earth-shaking election. That did not. FDR was still the president of the United States. You know, like so I don't think that that's. I'm not sold on your interpretation of it.
Okay.
All right.
But you're wrong. That's fine.
That's fine. So, spirit of the week.
Yeah. What are you drinking, Sonny?
I just made an old fashioned. I was drinking old Grandad 117. Or 114, whatever. Whatever that number is.
Very nice. Where's your cherry? Old fashioned. I don't see any cherries in there.
I don't put cherries in my old fashioned.
How about you have an orange slice?
Put seltzer water in there. Mush it up. Make it a.
You have a little Dole fruit cup.
Gross. Ugh.
Oh, do you remember those Dole fruit cups?
They were the best. Victorino? Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. The juice is in there from. It was mostly pears, if I'm not mistaken. The secret is pears. Go ahead.
The juices.
Gentlemen, do we have any corrections, additions, shout outs?
I do. Which is that listener and friend Steve Schmidt, not that Steve Schmidt, says that Steve Schmidt from Boston says that siren noise, who I grew up with, that siren noise I was hearing back in the day in Tom's River was not from Lakehurst, McGuire, or Fort Dix, but rather the Oyster Creek nuclear power plant. I don't know if that makes me feel any better.
Ooh. Silkwood kind of situation.
Yeah, 3 Mile Island situation. Okay. That's the only thing I have.
Okay, well, that's all the time we're giving to this episode. Questions, comments, complaints, compliments, tweet us at Sonny Bunch, at Victorino Mattis, or leave a comment at
jblast.com. You can tweet at jblast. He's back. He's on Twitter again.
We're there. Tell your friends. Until next time.
So, Wi-Fi update. As you noticed, there were two hiccups in the show. I think part of the problem is
somebody turned on their computer.
I have this mesh system, and I'm between two of the. I'm actually almost right in the middle of all three of them right now. I might be in a weird convergence spot, so I'm gonna work on this. So next week it's gonna be better
because it
week.
Just tipped over. You went from like very strong to
suddenly
very bad.
Again, I think the computer got slightly confused on which of the beacons it was supposed to latch on to. So we'll see. Mm-hmm. We'll see. Next week will be better.
Next week it'll be mesothelioma instead of the mesh. So,
can I share my brand new object of hatred?
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm afraid.
What do you hate?
His name is Jack Stoof. And I read about him in a piece in Outside Magazine. Do you guys?
They're going to say out.
Do you guys recall the Forrest Fenn treasure?
Yes.
So about 10 years ago, this rich guy went and hid a treasure somewhere in the Sierra Mountains and or Rocky. I don't know, some fucking mountains out west. And wrote a poem about it and a book and was like, somebody will find it and they'll become rich. Anyway, this guy named Jack Stoof found it. He found the treasure. Okay, good for him, I guess, right? As an undergrad, Jack Stoof went to Georgetown.
What class? No. That's what I want to know. What class?
He came out of Georgetown and he went and worked for Wonkette, where he was disgraced and fired.
Oh, I do remember that guy.
BuzzFeed, where he was disgraced and dismissed. He then somehow got into medical school. Because I guess this is a thing that when you fail as a, I'm sorry, when you fail as a journalist, you then move to medical school?
But you got to move down. You got to move down the ladder.
I was not aware that that's the direction these things flowed. I thought it was you fail to get into medical school and so you become a journalist. But then he gets into medical school. He doesn't really like it. So he's in medical school and trying to figure out how he's going to get out because medical school is really expensive and he doesn't want to be a doctor and he doesn't really enjoy it. And so he starts treasure hunting and he just goes and all by himself finds this treasure that everybody else has spent a decade looking
for. I need to ask, should I ask what's the actual treasure?
We don't know.
Oh,
we don't know. This is it's all super secret.
I think it would be so depressing to find out if it's, you know.
No, it's enough that he's going to be set for life, probably. And I don't know what sort of lucky star this asshole was born under, but I hate him. That's
so
all.
He must just be like, he must just have like an enormously high IQ.
You think?
I mean, that's the problem here is that he's just extremely smart and he thinks he can get away with things. That's why he keeps getting, you know, fired from being a journalist. Then he gets into med school because I'm sure he nails the MCATs, right? And then, like, he's like, I guess I'll go solve this puzzle that nobody can solve.
I don't think that IQ is the problem here.
Do you want me to end it now, or could I add to, you know?
No, go ahead, Victorino.
It is funny. It is funny. Speaking of Georgetown, going back to the, you know, we had to get this washer and dryer, you know, delivered, and it was from a mansion. And really nice lady. And after we delivered it, we had a little small talk and she was like, you know, so do I, how does this work? You know, how much do I owe you? You know, and of course they're like, no, we're, you know, this is what we do. I was like, I'll take $20. I said, but no, I said, never mind. No, I'm just kidding. And then find out that she, I don't know how we found this out. She went to Georgetown, as well. And then I found out that we're in the same class of 95. And
this old lady,
she wasn't old. I thought she was going to be old anyway. And then a friend of mine says, well, isn't it great that you were able to meet this person? I said, yes, it's great to meet a classmate of mine who lives in a mansion. It's really great.
I'm sure it's fine.